The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1.
Are short-term rentals worsening the long-term housing problem, and who's got the solution? A manufactured crisis, a key US congressman's Northern Ireland protocol prognosis, and are child and adolescent mental health services the Cinderella of an already Cinderella service? We'll have all that and more on tonight's Late Debate. It's Colm O'Mungon here in for Katie Hannan tonight, and joining me in studio are Neil Richmond, Fine Gael TD for Dublin Rathdown and party spokesman on European Affairs, Verona Murphy, Independent TD for Wexford, Thomas Gould, Sinn Féin TD for Cork North Central and party spokesperson on addiction, recovery and well-being, and Paul Hosford, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner. We want to hear from you, so please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. Well, first up tonight, housing and the Sinn Féin bill to fine short-term letting sites carrying ads for rentals that breach the 2019 planning law, specifically the section that limits short-term rentals to 90 days per year. Paul Hosford, what's the big new idea in tonight's bill?
Well, I suppose the big new idea is that there is no big new idea. And Owen O'Brien, who brought this bill, was very open about this. He said that, look, this is not a silver bullet. It doesn't fix the housing crisis. It doesn't even fix the short-term rental against long-term rental problem. What it does is it enforces the current guidelines. The last Cairn caller, Catherine Connolly, made the point that it was kind of odd to see the opposition bring a bill that would help enforce existing law rather than change the law. The government didn't oppose it, but Planning Minister Peter Burke did make the point that what the government has on deck, it's an action in Housing for All that would essentially create. They haven't really sketched out the full body of it, but what it would do is it would create a system where Fáilte Ireland would kind of enforce the existing rules. They are the 29 guidelines, as you said. They were brought in by then Housing Minister Owen Murphy. He brought in this rule. Basically, if you've got a home, you can rent it out for 90 days of the year, or if you want to do it for more than 90 days or more than 2 weeks at a time in one go, you have to go to your local authority to change for a change of use planning application. What Owen O'Brien wanted to do was introduce spot fines, which would have fined either estate agents or Airbnb, because they would do the largest volume of these short-term rents. Owen O'Brien kind of pictured as the cost of the rental per day was what would be fine. Peter Burke said that actually introducing spot fines would kind of be out of step with what we do, because what we actually have spot fines for are things like littering or speeding or you know, not having your NCT. We don't actually use spot fines for things like that. He pointed out that there's already there was a recent conviction under the existing law. It was a homeowner who was fined €1,000 under the planning guidelines. And he just reckoned that while the government wasn't opposing this idea, he reckoned that the government's and the government's plan overall is better. Thomas made the point there during the debate. Sorry, Thomas, I'm going to jump into. You've probably got your facts written down. That in Cork North Central, there's about 17, or in Cork City and County, there's about 1,700 Airbnbs. But if you go on to Daft, there's about 80 long-term rentals. And that's why Airbnb becomes this lightning rod in this debate. But what Airbnb says is, look, most people who rent out Airbnbs aren't renting out a whole home. They're probably renting out a room, or they might be renting out their shed, or there might be a converted yurt or a bus, or, you know, a hammock in between two trees somewhere in West Cork. And they said that even if you banned them overnight, you probably wouldn't return that many houses to the private rental sector. You might do maybe five or 800, but you wouldn't return the entire 5,000.
Okay, you mentioned Catherine Connolly there, the Independent TD for Galway West, the last Cian Corley there. Let's hear a flavour of what she had to say in today's proceedings.
We have a housing emergency. We must declare it, and we must take appropriate action to right what's happened, and that can only be done with acknowledgement. And the Minister stood there earlier on and asked for our cooperation. I will give him none. His ideology is to the private market. If you stand up, Minister, and tell me your ideology is practical to provide public housing on public land, you'll have my absolute 100% support. But that's not what's been said, and I am am tired of the duplicity and the hypocrisy of the language being used.
Catherine Connolly there. Neil Richmond, why the opposition to fines? Do you think they won't be effective, or is there a different objection to it?
Well, the government didn't object to the motion, I think, as Paul said out quite clearly, but they have said that they're bringing their own legislation in the next couple of weeks. And I think this could potentially be an example of how the Oireachtas can work. There is a problem. It's not the problem that, if it's solved, is going to solve the overall problem of the serious issue in our rental market, or indeed housing more widely. But the 2019 legislation clearly needs to be revamped. It was brought in, it was quite stringent at the time, but there is more that can be done. And what Minister O'Brien said earlier today on this station was that in the next couple of weeks he'll bring in stronger legislation. That fines alone won't solve this issue. It needs to be much more than that. Didn't dismiss the Sinn Féin idea out hand, raised, I would argue, kind of realistic questions, and also the point that this is something that hasn't been done before. So I look forward to the new legislation coming in. I think hopefully we can work across the houses to make it as effective as possible, and yes, get more rental units onto the opportunity for, you know, people across the country to raise it on a long-term basis.
So some of this might be seen in the legislation that's coming down the tracks. How far, just it's in the coming weeks, how developed is it? Or will some of what went through tonight be in it, be seen in it again? Will it inform any of the legislation that's going to come?
I wouldn't rule out that process, but the minister said it would be the next couple of weeks, the next 3 weeks. So I think it's fairly far along. But, you know, this is why we're in the legislative process. It's to take it through the stages, to look at it through committee stage, the Shannon and everything else.
Okay. Thomas Gould, you were comparing Airbnb to daft.ie to name two of the sites there. I think you said 1,400. It was whole homes on that,
yes,
versus 76. So there were no yurts or hammocks in question. It's a shocking contrast, but how accurate is it? How many of these are historic lettings? How many of these are actually available? What's behind that rather stark figure?
These are the figures today. They actually differ from yesterday. They've increased. So what we're looking at is entire apartments and homes that are available on short-term letting. What we're saying is, even if we could get a percentage of those turned in, it would help ease the housing emergency, as Catherine Connolly said today. We actually welcome the comments by Minister Noonan during debate when I was there. And actually the point that he made, and I give credit to Neil as well, we're trying to bring forward credible solutions, and the minister acknowledged that tonight. He said they're constructive, they're solutions. Obviously, they need to be worked with. Like, far too often, we're in the chamber and we're fighting with each other and we're disagreeing on policy or ideology. I think there was legislation came in 2019. What Owen is trying to do is bring forward an amendment. It won't solve the housing crisis, but it will make a difference to some people.
And how will it do that? Who's going to inspect these sites, what's on offer there, and who's going to enforce it?
You see, at the moment, each local authority would have to inspect. There was 1,432. And just to give you an idea, in the 3 years this legislation is in, Cork City Council have issued letters to 102. And of the 102, 24 were resolved. Now, we have 1,432 today. How can the local authority manage that? They can't. But what they can do is they can go after Airbnb, estate agents. So what you're doing, instead of dealing with 1,400 issues, you're dealing with half a dozen, maybe a dozen. Very easy to manage, and they need support.
Verona Murphy, you're in a county where there's plenty of property owners who have second homes that are holiday properties that no doubt make their way onto these kind of letting sites. Any concerns from what you heard tonight, or do you think they could be part of a solution?
Huge concerns. I just can't understand that, you know, if Sinn Féin and the government wanted to solve the housing crisis, they could, but they just refused to go back to basics and look at the whole planning structure. I mean, we're now blaming Airbnb for the housing crisis. There is no guarantee whatsoever that taking those houses, they're the houses, by
well,
the way.
In fairness, I think Owen O'Brien said he didn't think it was the silver bullet to solve everything, but it'd be
not
part of the solution.
They haven't come
is
up
what he
with
said
a silver bullet, because they're refusing, Colm, to look at the planning structure.
Well, Verona, there isn't
I'm
a
not
silver
finished
bullet.
Now. Just let, there is a silver bullet in the form of start from scratch, look at the planning. We have a huge issue. We see it starting with On Bord Pleanála. We have a regulator who's saying that we need to institute minimum densities that aren't in the legal framework. 35 dwellings per hectare is what they want to build. That's what's going into the county development plan in Wexford. that means you get a typology of apartments and terraced housing. Who wants to live in an apartment in Wexford? There's no transport infrastructure. They're costing 250,000 to build an apartment.
Well, that's
non-affordable. That's why they're not being built.
That's a separate issue.
But no, it's not, Colm.
But in terms of the rentals, on this issue of short-term rentals...
I can assure you, virtually every holiday home is now a residential tenancy. From my area, I live in the Hook Peninsula. I don't know of any holiday home that isn't actually rented on the basis of residential. Anybody that's doing Airbnb.
Could it be a solution in cities if you don't think it suits towns or rural areas?
Well, you got to look at the tourism and hospitality aspect of it. These are people who come, like it's opened up Ireland as a tourist destination. We have Airbnb. People who can't afford hotels come and stay in Airbnb. Are we closing that down? It's not, we can't blame this. Government have failed miserably to provide housing. For in the last number of 15 years, they failed miserably. And they keep bringing in regulation after regulation. They try policy after policy. Now we're giving developers 140,000 as a gift to build apartments where they're viable. It's beyond a joke. And it's something that they need to get to grips with. And we have to start with the basics.
All right, Neil, the problem is elsewhere and the government is tying things up in regulation. What's your answer to that?
Well, like, I still don't get how what Verona presents as a silver bullet. That's not going to solve the waiting list on social housing. It's not going to create a home. You gave it to me for interrupting you,
but they haven't built houses. Why?
What's the most important thing? To get houses built, and that's why we've had 31,000 commencement this year. But in addition to that, in the meantime, there is an issue, and I see it, and to credit former Senator Kevin Humphreys, I think raised it on a weekly basis when I was in the Shannon with him every week, that there was being in Dublin 4 area, in Dublin 2, around the Docklands, that there was long-term lettings not being allowed open for people who needed it for residential use. They were being completely siphoned off for corporate travellers and they were being left vacant for long parts of the year. And this is the huge issue. You have properties that weren't being used and instead it was more lucrative to be using it for 2 or 3 months for very high-end, be it corporate travels or tourism travels, rather than having it as a proper rental, which was built and which was actually meant, and these are places in very historic parts of Dublin, renovated to a high spec, meant to be inhabited to provide long-term homes.
Okay, Thomas.
Yeah, just 2 points. First of all, what this does, if you're not in a rent pressure zone, this doesn't affect you. So if you're in rural Ireland and you're using this property for tourism, it doesn't affect you. But what it does for cities, and like Cork, where I'm from, where over 20,000 students cannot get student accommodation, what this will allow you to do is will allow the person to rent it out for 90 days, short-term letting, over the summer, and then we can host students in it for the student year. So what you have here is the best of both worlds, and also if we can get some of those back to long-term letting, we're getting people who are... Like I said in the Dáil tonight, I had a family, 5 families, for the second week in the trot of my clinic on Monday, who have notices to quit. I have 30 families who must be out of homes by October. Now, this might take some of these families a chance, but the big thing, the big problem we have is vacancy. Almost 90,000 homes vacant right around the country could be turned around. Like the minister announced 450 million last week for developers. What we want to do is spend that money to turn vacant houses into homes and get people somewhere to live.
Verona, I'll come back to you in a minute on this. Paul, that issue of vacant housing came up in the Housing Committee today. We know that we don't know how many vacant properties there are, and it's nobody's job to know what the level of vacant housing is.
Yeah, and the Housing Committee today launched its report on urban generation. It's been having hearings since the turn of the year, hearing from architects and experts in urban design and hearing from people within the housing industry and the construction industry. And one of the things that they've recommended, there's 39 recommendations. The first recommendation straight off the bat is compile an accurate data set. We don't know how many vacant homes there are throughout the country. One of the Mel Reynolds had suggested there was about 137,000. Some people say it's higher, some people say it's lower. I think the Geo Directory puts it at about 90,000. And one of the points that was made by politicians across the board at this Housing Committee report launch was, Stephen Matthews, the Green Party, who's the chair, Owen O'Brien made the point, Kian O'Callaghan made the point, that they all basically said, even if there was 15 or 20,000, if it was that low, if you returned the majority of those to the housing stock, you could solve the homeless crisis overnight. You could put, you know, because you're talking about 10,000 people homeless. If you return 15, 20,000 homes to the active stock right now, using the repair and lease scheme or any of the comparative schemes around the country, you would put a massive dent into the housing crisis. The other thing is that it really feeds into Ireland's climate change goals, because as they always say about housing, the best built house in terms of, or the greenest house, is the one that's already built.
That's right, sure.
So retrofitting is a no-brainer in that regard.
I'd love to have the confidence in what Paul is saying. The reality is we don't have builders to build new houses, never mind renovations, never mind retrofits. I think the one thing about county councils overseeing this, it took Wexford County Council 10 months to...
And what's the level of vacant properties in Wexford, do you know? Or insofar as anyone knows anything, just anecdotally from what you can see in the constituency?
Somewhere in the region of maybe... There's about 600 that I'm aware of in the count, around the county. But they're not just vacant. Like, some of them are fair deal vacant and ready to live in. Others are absolutely derelict. And the point is, you could buy them. Would you get planning permission? It's almost impossible.
And
now we're back to basics again. It's planning is the problem here.
Neil Richmond, the Dublin City Council ran a pilot. The report details it, I think, of over 200 suspected vacant properties. Only about less than a quarter of them were actually vacant. And of those, I think it was in the teens as to how many were long-term vacant that, you know, the council could be sufficiently empowered to move on. How big is the problem from what you're seeing, and in terms of that point that Verona was making, getting the builders to do what's in effect a small job at scale? How is that going to be achieved?
Well, I think firstly, the problem does differ quite a bit where you are in the country. If you look at parts of Dublin, there isn't that many vacant houses. There are houses that they're in the process of being repaired, particularly those that are in local authority ownership. But there is proportionally a larger situation in terms of vacant properties, anecdotally based on conversations when the estate agents have made submissions or, you know, the valuers into county councils. But I fundamentally do agree with Verona. One of the biggest issues that we're facing is both the labour shortage and the material shortage in the construction sector. That's not unique to Ireland, but it is something that requires the whole of government approach to not just... It's great, and Simon Harris has loads of brilliant plans to get people to take up the trades and move into apprenticeships, but, you know, you're looking 4 or 5 years before those people can come in. But there are three other areas that need to have the work, and what I've worked quite closely with the Taoiseach is in terms of liberalising our work permit process for non-EEA applicants who can come from Ireland, who are skilled, who can build the homes, who would take the opportunities, not just homes, but also the industrial and commercial units that are pending, but also looking at allowing people to transfer skills who want to come in through the CAO process to update their skills, maybe to return to...
But the college places are not there for apprentices. You know, there are thousands of people who are doing the practical part of their apprenticeship on the list. But when it comes to getting them through colleges to a qualified position where they can actually sign off on jobs and progress construction projects, those college places aren't there. And that's been in existence since before COVID. So you need to upscale the capacity to educate apprentices, that formal education part of the apprenticeship.
Completely. And if you look at the plans that were launched by Minister Harris in the last fortnight, that's exactly what's doing it. It's upscaling the places, it's bringing in our new technical universities, but also it's making those courses a lot easier for people to apply to, so it's not seen as separate to the CAO system.
Thomas.
Yeah, listen, Colm, this is really very disappointing. We're listening to Neil Lowe talking about proposals. Fianna Gael have been in government for 11 years.
These are actions that have started.
Fianna Gael have been in government for 11 years, right? They're the reason we have a housing emergency now. And talking about hiring apprentices that will be ready in 5 years' time. Like,
Thomas,
Neil,
to be fair, I didn't interrupt you, but I think, to be fair, Thomas, you're taking words.
Let him finish his point.
It seems to be a policy of Fianna Gael and Fianna Fáil TDs when you state the facts to them.
But no, you're taking a selective argument.
The reason we're here
now
is because ye believe the market would solve the housing crisis. You were completely wrong.
And just moving into sloganeering now, Thomas.
Just to give you how out of touch Neil and the rest of Fianna Fáil and Fianna Gael are.
Well, before you get into that, you said that Fianna Fáil and Fianna Gael have been in government. There are councils all over the country. You could walk through local authority flats complexes and there are vacant flats there. And the spread of who's in control in local councils is far more evenly spread amongst the parties. How do we have situations like that where you have vacant flats that haven't been brought back into use?
There are 600 almost in Cork right now today. 600 vacant homes that we could put families into. But for Cork City Council to get funding, they have to apply to the Department of Housing, they have to wait to get sanctioned, and then they don't get the full amount. What I've asked
That's
the Minister
the
for... I've asked the Minister for numerous occasions, give the local authorities carte blanche to do up these houses and get the money back off the government. And just one last point is, there's a vacant horse officer.
One question for both yourself,
I'm just going to bring Verona in. Verona, you were complaining about regulation earlier. And if you're talking about bringing these overshop houses back in and apartments and that kind of thing, the regulations that are getting in the way of that are often disability access regulations and fire safety regulations.
Also,
it's not the kind of red tape you can cut out easily, is it?
That's the whole point. I made my speech in the Dáil this evening. We are top heavy with regulation.
Well, what's wrong with those regulations? What's wrong with fire safety and disability access
legislation?
Well,
we have to have them, but to what extent do we have to have them is the actual...
Well, presumably to the extent that buildings don't go on fire and people in wheelchairs can access
flats. Absolutely, but we keep adding layers of regulation. We keep having to retrain and to keep up with regulation. I'll ask, why did the SHD process fail? Why have we not seen the SHD process deliver housing?
Verona, you're talking about regulations. You're saying that Tory Brexit here talking about a bonfire
I'm talking about SHD. I'm talking about
following
the law.
Your initial point was
the
all the legislation.
I'm talking,
we're talking about
the
fire
SHD
access,
process didn't meet
access.
The planning requirements.
No, you've
government
the
not working within the law. Judicial review of which he lost. You keep bringing proposals that just don't work within the law. So each time we have a judicial review that overturns it, we don't end up with houses. That's the issue here. We have no housing. Any proposal that's been talked about here, we're years away from achieving
housing. You've said regulation is the problem a few times and you've said we need to get back to basics. If all of that regulation was stripped away, what then? What's the big spending solution that you would have to provide thousands of housing units? Let's assume all those regulations are gone. Then what?
They won't be all gone. The reality is it's costing €250,000 to build an apartment. Because of regulation, because of planning structures.
Let's assume that's dead. What's your idea? What are you proposing?
That we would build what people want.
And
people
who would
do
build
not.
It?
Well, the developers will build if they're viable. Planners will say consistently, viability is not their consideration. That needs to change. We have to have viability if developers are going to build. Other than that, we need to move to a model where the county councils just build houses and that's it.
Paul,
and we're nowhere near that.
Paul, one of the things that developers are reluctant to go near, we heard from local government managers speaking in front of the housing committee today, is fixed price tenders. Developers are reluctant to pitch for large projects because they don't know what the final cost is going to be and they're reluctant to get into a fixed price. They reckon it's going to disrupt construction projects between 2023 and 2024, and it's introduced a huge measure of uncertainty, they said.
Yeah, and this is one of the things, even if you strip away all of the regulations, even if you were able to come at it with an unlimited war chest, the Construction Industry Federation and the local government managers today told the Housing Committee that a lot of projects that were marginally viable at the start of the year are no longer viable because of the rising cost of materials. And the government has said repeatedly, and Darragh O'Brien said it on this station yesterday, that that's kind of out of the government's hands because it's an inflationary pressure across the globe. Allied with that, then you've got this shortage in construction skills. And Neil has pointed out rightly that the Higher Education Minister has announced sweeping changes to apprenticeship rules. But again, that's 5 years from having any real impact. You know, even Housing for All supposes that you might need to get to 80,000 workers in the home building sector alone. If you add on top of that rising material pressures, all of these contracts are under threat.
Thomas, rising construction costs, people not wanting to get into fixed price centres. Somebody has to protect the public purse. So what do you do in the instance where you can't simply say there is no fixed price or no price cap in a tender? How do you control the costs and at the same time get value for money?
Well, can I say we're going to spend €1 billion on HAP. So if we're talking about protecting the public purse, like we're giving landlords, speculators, investment funds and cuckoo funds a billion
sure,
a year.
Sure, but if you get apartments out of Airbnb and onto the private rental market, the only people that are going to be paying for that are going to be HAP as well. So in a way, I mean, the proposals you were tabling tonight also put more on stream for private landlords who'll benefit from HAP as well.
Well, you see, what we want to do is, and I raised it at this housing meeting today, we have no local authorities building building direct build. And the question
is, are they
is,
not going to fall victim to construction inflation too? If it's materials and labour supply
and the reason the difference is local authorities don't need to make a profit. Like we're talking, Verona's making a point there in relation to planning in the private sector. We have 120,000 people on the social housing list. We have people who can't afford to buy houses, who are earning too much on social housing and who haven't got enough to get a mortgage. And then we have people who want to rent in. They can't rent. What we're proposing is both private developers, but also we need local authorities to build masses amounts of social, affordable and cost rental houses. Because, being honest, the government plans at the moment will not deliver that.
But Thomas, those plans have started. The Land Development Agency has put in for planning. In my own constituency, 150 cost rental units opened in the estate I live in just 2 weeks ago. We now have the Land Development Agency over 1,000 homes in Dundrum. This is the state building social and affordable housing. This is exactly what you're doing. It's not somehow saying that, well, the local authority can do it. They don't have the staff. They don't have the skill set. You have the Land Development Agency able to act in this manner. But it's never going to be enough. Like, you want it to be fully nationalised. It's not realistic.
Can I just explain one thing? Kevin's site in Cork is one of the sites that Neil is talking about. 10 years ago, Sinn Féin proposed that in Cork. It took 10 years and the site hasn't even started. And this is the problem with Fianna Gael. They believed the market was going to solve the problem. We gave them solutions. They wouldn't listen.
Like, Thomas, that's the second time you've just come out with a very political slogan. You know, the problem with Fianna Gael, the market things. Like, we've been hearing it for you constantly.
But it's the truth.
No, it's not just the truth, because when we're putting to you genuine solutions and genuine approaches, we had a discussion earlier on in this show and earlier on in the chamber where we can work together. But instead, when it comes back to basic, you want to say, oh no, you're only made of
when you work together,
market.
You'd hope there'd be a result.
If you look at the policies,
if you read Fiona Redden's article in the Irish Times on Saturday, people are not buying apartments. Even it's whether they can't or they won't. They won't. They don't want to live in them. If you use up your first-time buyers or your first-time buyers grant, as we call it, you don't use it on an apartment because now it's used and you want to move on and rear a family with the front and back garden in a nice three-bedroomed house. Why are we building apartments? People don't want them. 35
well,
densities.
That's a blanket. There are apartments that would be suitable for rent
in Dublin. In cities, in Dublin only. This is where governments propose. This is where Dublin's.
City people have to live somewhere too, Verona.
Sorry, Wexford's an urban area. It's not apartment urban. Nobody wants to live in an apartment in Wexford. We may require.
Have you spoken to everyone in Wexford and said they don't want to live in apartments?
I absolutely have. I mean,
every single person. Will it be written up, Verona? Come on now. That's a ridiculous statement.
Neither have you. And when you quote Dundrum is not Wexford.
No, but I can point to you at hundreds of apartment developments where people have bought the houses and moved in.
Now has
people do want to live in apartments.
I'm
That's
sorry,
a terrible statement to say like that.
Have you looked at the typology of what 35 dwellings per hectare, the size of the house you're talking about?
Verona,
have you seen it?
Do you know
what it entails?
But you're saying no one wants to live in apartments. That is not a correct apartment. You've said it four times.
People
in
Wexford, why aren't they buying them then? Tell me why they're not buying them. Why is Fiona Redden's
article? I want to ask you, the proposal for developers to be able to claw back 70% of the government proposal for developers to be able to claw back 70% of costs inflation that have been caused by construction inflation. The Construction Industry Federation have welcomed that, but one of the issues is that it's hard to raise the finance in the first place before you ever claw anything back. I mean, can you see any other way where people would be incentivized to build in an area of construction inflation and at the same time protect the public purse? If the public is spending money, you can't just have open-ended tenders.
No, you can't.
With no
and
price
I mean, it's
control.
An outrageous proposition to actually subsidize the building of apartments at the level of 140,000.
Well, it's not all apartments.
I'm just saying that's an outrageous proposal. The clawback is that many companies would fold under the pressure that's there at the moment. Developments wouldn't be completed. There'd be no shovel ready going on. The reality is that 70% currently is something that is government's failure to deal with inflation. It's as simple as that. The cost of living for everybody is continuing to rise. They could take 15 cent off the price of fuel in the morning, and they won't do it.
Can you expect the government to deal with the cost of timber and concrete? And
of course, they caused the problem by not issuing filling licences.
They can't control the price of gas, and cement kilns are fired by gas.
They can control the controllables, Colm, and the controllables are that they are taxing the tax. We have 98 cent out of almost, we have over 98 cent out of a euro 86 the last time I checked on a litre of petrol going to the government. They charge 23% VAT on all of the excise, which is excise duty, it's biofuel additive, it's the carbon tax. If they were to remove the VAT from the excise and all of the other carbon taxes, they would save the consumer 15 cent a litre. In the morning.
Oh, we're gonna leave this. Let's have a look at what the listeners have been saying. Fix up, paint up, and clean up the idle houses dotted around the country.
Yeah.
Easier, cheaper, and faster than building all of these thousands of new houses, and it gives new life to old towns. Another text says everybody knows the only cure to the housing crisis is for the government to build thousands of houses on government land. Another text, as a first-time buyer that'll never afford 300,000 plus apartments, give me access to the repair and lease scheme, retrofit and a state council-backed mortgage because banks won't touch most doer-uppers that aren't quite derelict and I'll bite the hand off you. And finally then, my son couldn't get student or any other accommodation in Limerick and had to drive up and down from Galway every day for college. There's nothing available now for next year. All right, well, we're going to move on to the Northern Ireland Protocol because Democrat Congressman Richie Neal has been to Brussels, London and landed in Dublin as head of a bipartisan congressional delegation. And he was airing the suspicion today that concerns over the Northern Ireland Protocol look like they're manufactured. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of a welcome that gets him when he meets the DUP in Belfast. Paul, Richie Neal, he's not just any congressman. He's chair of the Ways and Means Committee, which kind of vets the prospective trade deals, and the UK is looking for one of them with the US. But the constant reference to the Good Friday Agreement by congressmen from the US and from US representatives, in a way, it's kind of backfired to the extent that the British government has now developed its Good Friday Agreement argument of its own, and the DUP is providing the evidence for them on the ground that the protocol is affecting the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the things about something like this visit by nine members of the US Congress is that sometimes we can get into a bit of forelock tugging when we're faced with American politicians. But the intervention by these US politicians to kind of, I suppose, give their support to the Good Friday Agreement, to give their support to the Northern Protocol, is seen, particularly in government circles, as very welcome, because like you mentioned, that US-UK trade agreement is very important to everyone in the UK, and a potential obstacle in the shape of the Ways and Means Committee would be a very, very serious one to overcome. But I suppose I'm not sure if it's seen as backfiring, this hands across the world tour by these US congressmen, but I think here in Dublin it is seen more as a positive than a negative. I do think, I suppose, that the DUP's reaction to it, Geoffrey Donaldson tweeted while Richie Neal was on his feed in the Shannon to say that he was supporting Sinn Féin dogma around the protocol. So you can already see the reaction there, but I think in Dublin it is seen as a very welcome visit.
Neil, the Irish government position is that there are legitimate unionist concerns with the protocol and they can be worked on. So how is the intervention by Richard Neal helpful that he's saying this is a bit of a manufactured crisis? If there are legitimate concerns there, then they're legitimate concerns.
Of course there's legitimate concerns. There's legitimate concerns when it comes to identity, but also the practicality of how the protocol is working. And up until the 24th of February, the European Commission and the British government were in detailed discussions to how to resolve those problems. However, after war broke out in Ukraine, those discussions were paused, understandably. This was with the new negotiator lead-in. And then we see a slew of scandals in UK domestic politics, another one kicking off today. And all of a sudden we see Liz Truss shaping up not just to invoke Article 16, but promising domestic legislation to unilaterally change the protocol, despite an election to Northern Irish Assembly that saw parties that backed the protocol gain a serious majority. Now, what we have is the prospect, and Richie Neal's right, there is an element of this is manufactured completely.
Which element of it?
I think first and foremost, the folk concern for the Good Friday Agreement from so many people in the Tory backbenchers and the people in the ERG, the people who spent most of their career railing against the Good Friday Agreement and have consistently dismissed any concerns that were raised by the Irish government, all parties and none represented at this table during the Brexit process and prior to the referendum. All of a sudden, we have to believe that Liam Fox is an expert in the Good Friday Agreement, David Davis, Michael Gove, two men in their journalistic careers who wrote at length about how it was such a bad deal. Then we have the DUP who are talking about consent and cross-community consent. They had no problem with this when Northern Ireland voted against Brexit. They had no prospect of bringing this into discussion when repeatedly a majority of people in the North weren't happy with any of the previous government's solutions to it. However, when it came to the backstop, architected by Theresa May, they found a reason to oppose it despite having the balanced power in government. And here we are once again, a reason to oppose it and indeed have a cut at a very powerful congressman who's been an excellent supporter of the peace process.
Okay, Thomas Gould, your party is pro-protocol. It's one of the, your assembly members are some of the 53 out of the 90 that are in favour of the protocol. But the protocol, as it was envisaged, has never been fully implemented. And there are issues with the protocol. So, I mean, are there bits of the protocol that you'd at least share some of the concerns of the DUP about that you'd like to see mitigated, or certain, what checks would you like to see removed that are currently in existence or that will be coming once the removal of grace periods happens?
Well, what our attitude would be, if there are genuine concerns with the DUP and the British government, like, to be fair, I think we have to be, Europe has been done everything to work with both the Irish governments and the British governments and the Northern Executive to try to find solutions. But to be fair, and I have to agree with Neil, some parts of this have been manufactured. You've got controversy going on in England at the moment, and you can't beat the Tory party standing up to Europe and saying, we won't accept what you're saying. Like, to be honest, we have a peace process in place. We have the Good Friday Agreement. We have the majority of people in the North who want the executive to be established, who want Michelle O'Neill in as the First Minister, who want to deliver housing, health, the cost of living crisis. This is what the people of the North want. And Boris Johnson, unfortunately and disappointingly, is playing politics with the DUP. No, Boris Johnson...
He does say that he doesn't want to scrap the protocol. He says he's not going to nix the protocol. He wants to have certain changes to it. And the British government position is that if they can arrive at an agreement, they won't pass this legislation that they're proposing to pass. So it may be avoidable and there may be room, albeit ever narrowing grounds, for an agreement between the UK and the EU over this.
Well, they're talking about legislation. The question would be, if there wasn't a controversy going on in the UK at the moment, would Boris Johnson take this position? And all I would say is, like, at the end of the day, negotiation between Ireland, England, the EU and the North, that common sense has to prevail and we need to work together.
Verona, this bit of a chosen subject for you and Mastermind as well, going back to your previous career in road haulage, but like big export focused businesses with staff to do the paperwork are fine with coping with the protocol. There is an opportunity for them to export to the EU single market and into Great Britain and to, as I say, to do the paperwork. For smaller firms, it's not as easy. And for the mixed consignments that are coming to Northern Ireland, there are problems being caused. I mean, what are you hearing?
They're all the problems that we're dealing with in the South and paying the cost of Brexit and have been doing so since Brexit occurred. I mean, we're managing, and it has added to the costs, of course. But the reality here is Northern Ireland has in no way had to implement anything like we have in the South. The EU has bent over backwards.
Yeah.
I have to be honest with you. Like all the traders in the North that I've dealt with over the years, and I'm still in touch with, and so are the Irish Road Haulage with the Northern Ireland Road Haulage. They say, basically, they can get on, they can manage, they have the best of both worlds.
And does it smell like a manufactured crisis to you?
Of course it's manufactured. There's no smell.
What's behind it?
If it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And I think you have Geoffrey Donaldson, who, as Neil quite rightly pointed out, the Good Friday Agreement wasn't on his agenda when Brexit was actually being talked about. We went to great lengths and for years to say what damage would be caused. They want, basically, they want the protocol name only.
Okay, Neil, there are proposals there that you could have, and they're coming from both sides. You could have two channels for goods that are going to remain in Northern Ireland and for those that are going to travel onwards to the EU single market through the Republic, that you'd have a channel going in. The British call it the red and green channel. The European Union is prepared to entertain this. The difference is what data dictates what goes into which channel. The UK government doesn't seem happy or hasn't given the level of access to customs data to EU inspectors. To date, they say commercial data is fine. But is there a landing zone between those two positions that could mitigate the checks?
I hope so, but I'm extremely cynical at this stage. Cynical throughout this entire Brexit process, that throughout this scenario, you have potential proposal, talk of landing zones, the EU, as Verona rightly said, bending over backwards, going against all its internal rules to present a package of proposals in October that were dismissed outright. And if we do find a landing zone, when you have a British government that's constantly threatening Article 16 or talking about unilateral action, can they be trusted? And ultimately, the easiest solution for most of the problems would actually be for an EU-UK SPS or veterinary agreement that would remove 80% of checks overnight. This is the problem when you have a very hard Brexiteer British government. They're the ones who are driving the problems in the scenario when it comes to the protocol. It's not necessarily the protocol itself. And unfortunately, for political reasons, it's been jumped on by elements of political unionism, very malevolent elements, particularly in terms of we saw at the rallies and we saw the threats given. And it's something that isn't in the interests of Northern Irish people, and crucially, be it the farming organisations or the business groups who've consistently said they can make the protocol work. And the proof is in the pudding that Northern Ireland's economy is performing much better than the rest of the UK's.
Paul, you wanted to come in there a second ago.
Yeah, sorry. I suppose on that level of manufacture, I thought it was interesting last night that the leak to I think it was the Telegraph or the Express, one of the friendly Tory papers, that this legislation will be coming within the next couple of weeks, came within an hour of ITV's revelation of this picture of Boris Johnson at a party during lockdown. The timing of it felt cynical. Some people I spoke to in government felt the exact same, that the timing was very, very handy, that this legislation all of a sudden was back on the table or was forthcoming. It was within an hour of the Prime Minister's being spotted. But
it's not a new thing, the legislation, because RT's Europe editor Tony Connolly was doing an analysis on the utterances of David Frost going right back, just as Maros Shevchevich was laying out his proposals for mitigating some of the effects of the protocol. Within days of that, David Frost was already talking about the potential for legislation to be passed on this. So it hasn't been provoked necessarily by this particular crisis. There may be an ideological aspect to it that's not manufactured. It's simply what Neil was talking about, the hard Brexit aspect of things, Verona.
Yeah, but I think if you go back to what you were saying about David Frost, the reality is that they're not entitled to do that. We've compiled an agreement that took us months, years, blood, sweat and tears, and they're prepared to break it. I think Boris Johnson's underestimating the damage that he's actually doing to, you know, on an international agreement. I think he's underestimating the effect that that's going to have on Britain.
Within the North, Thomas, is there any kind of potential dialogue, any back channels, anything going on to try and agree amongst the parties to get something done on a phased basis, so that while the protocol has been discussed in Westminster, at least some business could be done in Stormont?
We're very keen to get Stormont back. No, we'd like to get it back fully, but even if we could get a speaker elected, that would give Michelle O'Neill and the other MLAs an opportunity. But the problem here is the DUP feel emboldened by the support of the Tories and Boris Johnson, and as a result, they're holding the executive to ransom. And let's be honest, the majority of people in the North want the executive up and running to deal with day to day. Like, the one good thing, and I was up canvassing on the ground, attitudes have changed. This dem in us is starting to reduce. People are starting to look at it now from how they want to live, how they want the children to live, the education. It's different now. Like, the North have huge issues in relation to cost of living, housing, health and many more. They want the executive to step up now and sort it up. But the problem is, as long as Boris Johnson and the Tories are giving a blank check to the DUP to hold it to ransom, it's wrong. And the thing here is, it looks like to me that the Tory party went for a Brexit and now they want their cake and eat it, and they can't have it.
Okay. All right. Coming up, what's wrong with child and adolescent mental health services?
The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1. The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1.
It's Cullum O'Mungo and standing in for Katie Hannan tonight. If you want to get in touch, you can get us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. The sorry state of child and adolescent mental health services in the state was raised today by Dublin South independent TD Joan Collins. Waiting lists up 40% since this time last year, while inpatient beds in the Lindara facility have been cut in half. The Taoiseach gave this reply.
And at the first instance, I want to say that the Minister, Mary Butler, is working with the HSE intensively to make sure that this is a temporary situation and to get this reversed. In relation to Lindara, the regrettable situation has come about because a number of nursing posts have become vacant simultaneously for various reasons. It's not a resources or a funding issue, but a staffing recruitment issue. The nursing complement available through the use of permanent and agency staff is no longer sufficient to continue to provide a full 24-bed inpatient service to a safe standard.
Paul, 4,000 people on a waiting list, fewer places for the most acute places to go. It's not a great first experience of a mental health services for people who need early life interventions.
No, and then you've got a further 8,000 who are on child psychiatric waiting lists for over a year. So that early intervention thread gets lost. You've got questions about what happens to people when they get to the top of that waiting list. Do they actually get access to it? I suppose one of the things that's really important here is to remember that these are child and adolescent mental health beds. These are for very, very vulnerable children. These are for children who need specialist treatment, who need teams of specialists to work with them. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to be having kids going to do their state exams, and the message is going to go across to them that, look, if you're not feeling well, if your mental health is suffering, talk to somebody. A 15-year-old's best friend is not well placed to deal with somebody who needs a CAMHS bed. They're just not able to handle
services in the community, even organisations the likes of Jigsaw that do laudable work, will refer more complex cases onwards. But what can they refer them on to if this is the state of the service?
And this is the point. There's nowhere to send people. If you have to access crisis mental health, and I have been in that situation myself, I have had to access it. If you go public, you have to wait. And if you're in what you think is a crisis, you are going to have to wait, or you're going to have to hope that you can get access. Access to mental health services is the silver bullet. We talked about in housing there being no silver bullet. There is one in mental health services, and it's access to specialist treatment. And if you can't get that, you're put in a very, very difficult situation that could end in the worst possible way.
Verona Murphy, the money that was supposed to fund Vision for Change was through the sale of properties. And it became a geographic lottery. If you had a large former facility in your country, like the likes of St. Sennans in Wexford, it was closed on the property sold. But even still, the community services never materialised.
Never materialised. We have two CAMHS units in Wexford, never have been fully staffed. We had a child psychiatrist, Dr. Kieran Moore, who left, simply a very dedicated individual, but left because there was no support structure. At the moment, we have 23 young adolescents suffering with anorexia, primarily during COVID. This arose as a big issue. We don't even have a dietitian, a paediatric dietitian, on the CAMHS team. It's not a stipulation. So, and we haven't even got a paediatric dietitian in Wexford General Hospital. CAMHS is, you know, we haven't done an ADHD assessment in CAMHS in 6 months in Wexford. This is something now that's starting to come up because they were going to base the review on CAMHS in Kerry on maybe ADHD assessments. So they stopped doing them on the basis that they couldn't really do a review in Wexford. It's so convoluted, and the reality is we're letting our children down. Parents are being let down. Families are suffering. You know, there is nothing about CAMHS that works around the country. We have a recruitment and a retention crisis in the HSE that's having a catastrophic effect on our young adults.
Well, maybe it's a bit of a blanket statement to say there's nothing in CAMHS that work, but there are significant problems. Thomas, it's not funding, it's recruitment and retention. A former head of the HSE Mental Health Services said some years ago that
you know, consultant child and adolescent practitioners are in huge demand all over the world. The conditions, the money is better elsewhere. The level of expertise to retain it here is a huge challenge. And even within the country, when vacancies are advertised, it's often people moving from one part of the country to another rather than attracting new expertise into the service.
You see, to say that it's not a funding or a resource issue is not right. Because, like, why would a person want to work in a job where they're constantly under pressure, they're constantly under stress, and they know that they're the last line for a lot of these vulnerable children and adolescents? Like, what we need is to support the workers. It's a catch-22 situation. If we don't invest
enough... But the money is there, but it often goes unspent. And the reason it's unspent is because they either can't recruit or can't retain. The issue is not necessarily the provision of money, unless, and you may well be, are you talking about a substantial increase in the pay and conditions for the likes of child and adolescent mental health service consultants?
And we're also talking about, we have colleges, why aren't we producing enough experts to manage CAMHS and many other services? Like, we're talking about recruitment and retention, but if we're not delivering enough of professionals every year, and people say, and you listen to the Taoiseach and the Minister say that this is not a resources issue, it is most certainly, because if our colleges were producing these specialists and these professionals, then we could get the people into CAMHS. But let's put it this way, why would people stay in the jobs with the pressure they're under now?
Okay, Neil Richmond, accessing the services is one thing, but for the likes of people getting an inpatient bed, the level of distress you have to be in to be triaged to the top of the queue is phenomenal. It's only the most distressed people that are being engaged by what's in effect a firefighting service.
Yeah, and look, I think we've all experienced that individual phone call from a distressed mother or a distressed parent. I've had it with a number of girls in recent months who've been, you know, near death's door with eating disorders, and you're trying to navigate a Byzantine system that isn't fit for purpose for the patient. In terms of resources and finances, that's only so good if, firstly, you have the people. There may be enough people coming out of college, but they're only filling the places because other people are deciding to go elsewhere. And crucially, I think that organization of the structure, it's the coordination between the entire national service, is something that requires a complete relook at, for want of a better word.
Sorry, but just going to Paul's point on that, it's not only a geographic lottery, but it's also a health insurance lottery for a lot of people. That the type of service you access depends on what kind of health insurance you have. You can get 180 days inpatient with the VHI. The standard is 100 for most other health insurance policies. So even if you are insured, there's still an aspect of differentiation there. How is it not just on the basis of need when people present with acute mental health difficulties or people need an early intervention that there is this division between people who can seek private care and people who are left in the public service, which doesn't seem to have as much specialist resources at its disposal?
Well, I suppose I would argue that the resources, there are more special resources in the public system. However, the amount of bed nights available in terms of the private system is considerably more. You're not necessarily getting the same amount of treatment in the private system as you are in the public.
But even to get an assessment, it's easier got through the private system in order to be able to say for the need. For
an
the
initial
needs.
Assessment, though, in terms of the full detailed assessment as you go through the full firefighting in a very time-sensitive manner, I would argue that the public system is better. However, the organisation is clearly not working to its optimum, partly due to resources in terms of the number of staff. But secondly, I would go back to the coordination. You mentioned the geographic lottery about services that are overweighted, and we've seen how that's been very clearly exposed in the last couple of days in the Munster region.
Paul, you wanted to come back.
Yeah, I think the frustration with this is from the public particularly, is one of the frustrations that comes around with a lot of things. The Taoiseach's language today about it being a recruitment and a retention issue was very passive. If you've got, and he made the same comments about the Kerry CAMHS scandal earlier this year, if you've got a recruitment and retention problem, you have to work out what that recruitment and retention problem is. And you asked Thomas, does that mean you just up the pay and conditions of the people involved? If that's what it needs to be done, if any private sector business was struggling to hire people, they're told, we're seeing it in the hospitality industry, they're being told, if you can't recruit people, pay them more. If you can't recruit people for CAMHS, something as vital as child and adult mental health services, you go and you pay them more.
Well, on the CAMHS issue, and you mentioned the Kerry situation there, where people were finding themselves being inappropriately prescribed medication and overprescribed medication in certain cases, that's not limited to CAMHS in the mental health services, where there aren't complementary psychological services in place. Medication is there as a firewall against distress, and it has significant physical impacts on people, medication. People can undergo serious weight gain, and going back to what you were saying, Verona, the whole body image issue, in a way, you end up in this vicious cycle of taking medication to deal with mental distress and then having the body image issues to go with it.
Well, I think the particular issue with CAMHS and Kerry was the oversight of the medication. But I want to just go back and correct what you rightly pointed out. When I say CAMHS doesn't work, I mean from an administrative level. The people who provide the care are exceptional, yeah, but they are put under such pressure. I asked my own area, CHO5, are they doing exit interviews? No, they're not doing exit interviews. We don't know why these people, why we're hemorrhaging staff. And I'm constantly told it is not a funding issue. But we've had a CDN nurse moved from CAMHS in Wexford to CAMHS North for no apparent reason.
I'm afraid that's the last word from you, Verona. Yeah. That's all from us tonight. The programme was produced by Penny Hart, researched by Andrew Fleming. The BCO was Shane Galvin and Harry Buckless was on sound. Stay tuned for Cathal Murray with The Late Debate. But first, we'll hand over to Michael Corcoran on the Sports Desk.